Today's Galazzo is Granata flavoured. They were one of the greatest teams of all time. They won five straight Scudetti. They saw off war, racial terror, and every opponent put before them. But they lost their lives in one of the greatest sporting tragedies ever. Today, we salute Il Grande Torino.
Arriva in quarta l'auto tascabile con le mascotte delle due squadre. De Petrini Junior porta anche la giustificazione di papà, oggi assente. Dono per i capitani Rava e Mazzola. Eccolo i 10 Granata e si merita quel 10.
Yes, indeed, we're going back, way back for today's Golazzo, all the way to the 1940s, where we're joined by Gabriele Marcotti. Welcome back, Gabriele.
Great to be back.
And James Horncastle.
Hello. How old were you then, Jimbo?
We're almost at the anniversary of the Superga air disaster, which remains the defining moment, sadly, of what many say is the greatest Italian team ever. And, of course, just last week, Sauro Tomà, the last surviving member of that side, passed away at the age of 92. So it seems a good time to remind people who that club were, who the team were, how it all ended for them, and maybe ask what could have been if it hadn't had that tragic end. Torino, Gabriele, first of all, a lot of people know them as a kind of middling Serie A side at best, but this is one of the grandest clubs of all.
Torino's current lot is what you see with sort of second teams, I don't say that in a disparaging way, in a lot of major cities around Europe, you know, where a bit like Highlander, there can be only one. As the game polarizes, everything pushes towards one team. And you can probably do a parallel, and goodness, I'll get abused for this, but with Everton, perhaps, in this country, Manchester City before Sheikh Mansour, a lot of cities like that, which just simply aren't big enough or weren't big enough to support two powerhouses. That's been Torino's dimension of late. Mm. But, you know, you go back to a different era and it was very much a different story. And, you know, we wonder what would have happened had Superga not occurred. And there's obvious another obvious parallel with Manchester United and Munich, obviously. Mm. But I think the other thing to note was that I wonder what would have happened if World War II hadn't occurred.
Right.
In the sense that, you know, they won their first title in 1942-43. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there was, 3 years without football as well. I mean,
unleashing the dominance of the firemen of La Spezia.
Yeah. Who, unfortunately, never were assigned that title.
That's
formally.
So bad, isn't it? Could you just explain, James?
Well, during 1944, I think in the north of Italy, football was split into three groups, and the winners of those groups played each other. So Torino was one, Venezia was another one, and the Fire Brigade of Spezia was the other, and the Fire Brigade of Spezia won. But that was right in between Torino's sort of, five consecutive straight titles.
And it's not officially counted.
So it's not officially counted, yeah. But they did, if you like, get in the way of it.
Mm. Well, as did the Second World War, as it did with so many things, Gabriele. Let's go back then to where Il Grande Torino started, how that extraordinary side came about. And it's the start of the 40s when Ferruccio Novo takes over, Torinese industrialist, takes over this club that's won one Scudetto, which they basically won it in 27. Then that got revoked for match fixing. And then they won it the next season anyway. So they've won a title. He takes over in the early 40s and he starts to assemble a team.
Yeah, and in part because of his background, because he was more well traveled, I think he was far more open minded than perhaps his contemporaries at the time, especially in that context. I mean, you have to remember that this was Mussolini's Italy, right? And so he was certainly not averse to looking at what was happening in other countries, seeing how a modern football team should be run, could be run, and turning to some people who might have been a bit undesirable at some of the more, shall we say, fascist football clubs in Italy.
And you're talking specifically there about the manager above all.
Yeah. this extraordinary character of Vegli Erbstein. There's a wonderful book about it.
Yeah, Dominic Bliss.
Dominic Bliss, that's
right. Yeah, it's extraordinary work. And the detail there of what happens to Erbstein and on his route as a football player. He even ends up in Brooklyn at one point, comes back to Italy, plays various places, Vicenza, starts managing at Bari, has great success at Lucchese, and that's where Norvo decides this is the guy for us at Torino. But even then, he almost had to live in hiding while managing Il Grande Torino.
Yeah, I mean, what he did at Lucchese is nothing short of extraordinary, really. You can understand why people were looking at him and thinking this guy is a very talented coach, because he took them from, what, the 4th Division to a mid-table Italian side, and this is a club from Lucca. And yeah, with Erbstein, he, I think, got the job in, what, 1939? And then basically he leaves Lucca because you know, his daughter, Susanna, sort of gets kicked out of school there because of, you know, their Jewish heritage.
Yeah, those who haven't worked it out.
This is a year after the 1938 Manifesto of Race, which effectively brought in racial laws in Italy.
He moves north, yeah, thinking it might be better there. But yeah, his daughter's what, privately educated. For a period, he lives in hiding in, I think, Novo's apartment in Via Mica. And then basically organizes a job swap to get out of Italy, where he's due to go and coach this team in Rotterdam, Xerxes. The guy who is the coach of that team basically said, I'll come and coach Torino. And then as they're sort of going to Holland, they have to go through Germany, and they get kicked off the train, put in this kind of in this apartment block where all Jews were kept. And being the smart guy that he was, he, I think, traded all his money for diamonds, basically gets one of the guards to allow him to use the phone to call Ferruccio Novo, who basically then gets onto the consulate and says, right, we'll organize you to go back to Hungary, to Budapest, where he lives for, what, another 9 years, sets up a textiles business with his brother. But obviously, you know, Hungary in that time also comes under far-right regime, fascist regime, and gradually it catches up with them.
He ends up in a work camp. Mm. And then there's this extraordinary story that he actually escapes from a train, which is heading towards a concentration camp, I think, with Bela Gutmann.
Yeah, again, one of the great coaching minds of that generation, and seems to have managed to survive, him and his family, who, yeah, his girls, for example, were for a long time, I think, in a convent which was on Vatican territory. So it was, in theory, the Nazis could not get to them.
Like the Sound of Music.
Yes. And you had, what, various, not only sort of Vatican diplomats, but also Swedish diplomats, like, Wallenberg.
Mm.
Doing everything in his power to save as many Jews as possible. And, you know, it's not confirmed, but I think there was a period where he worked in that Swedish legation, because, you know, after living and working in Budapest for 9 years, you know, he knew the local community and knew where he could, you know, maybe help Wallenberg save other Jews like him.
So Erbstein survives the war, his family survived the war, and he makes his way back to Italy in the kind of aftermath of post-war Italy still trying to pick itself up from...
I mean, there's all this amazing speculation, really, about during the war itself, whilst he was in Budapest, he would, or at least on one occasion, came back to Italy, a great risk to his life, to see Novo, hoping that, I think, Novo would use his industrial contacts to help him and his brother get his textiles business off the ground. But also, yeah, he spends a little bit of time in Trieste, a little bit of time in Venice, where some of the members of this Grande Torino side were either emerging or playing. And there's the suggestion that there was a constant discourse going on between him and Novo as to who the team should sign, what the team should look like. And Novo certainly felt that the continuity that they had in that time, even throughout all this extraordinary circumstances of the war, obviously served them in very good stead. It was one of the reasons why they were so successful in that period.
Well, the circumstances of the war, and a lot of people would look at it and think, how on earth could you have a championship while essentially half the country is under an occupying force, or in fact both sides are, but different occupying forces. Torino basically, they became Fiat Torino. This is bizarre. So Juve's historic backers actually ended up forging a partnership with Torino for the purposes of giving the players an official occupation so that they wouldn't be called up for the front lines by the Italian army. Juventus themselves emigrated to Alba to avoid, I guess, personal risk, and were sponsored by a different car company.
Yeah, Cisitalia. Mussolini, I mean, to go back to what you were saying there about why were they still playing football for a long period, really, throughout this war. Mussolini thought the war would be over quite quickly. He thought that it was good to show that there was business as usual going on, i.e. Serie A was still being played, and that these players were better service to their country playing football than they were on the front line.
Erbstein returns, and although they've already won one title in 43, this is where the real Grande Torino takes the field. What kind of football did Erbstein bring to Torino?
We're limited in what we know because all we have is some sort of grainy YouTube pictures with funny commentary and the contemporaneous accounts of the time, which you kind of realize a lot of times they were somewhat over the top. But by all accounts, he put together a really dynamic team above all. It's a very attacking side, and a side that managed to sort of fuse athleticism and technique to great effect. I think they averaged, there was one season, I think, they set the Serie A goals record one season. I think
it was 125
goals. They averaged more than three goals a game more than once. And while people did score more goals back then, I mean, it was still quite an extraordinary feat. And I think the other thing which struck you was he was one of the first people, from what I read, who got the skill players to really work. So, you know, we've spoken in the past on the show about, you know, Giuseppe Meazza, who'd kind of, you know, he'd have nights with loose women and then go on the pitch, walk around, and then he'd only kind of spring to life when the ball got to him. And that didn't happen. There was a discipline and sort of a collective ethos to this Torino team where, you know, even people like Valentino Mazzola would run and tackle back and have that humility.
And part of that regime, that discipline regime, was Leslie Leavesley, who's a former Man United and Crystal Palace defender who shares managing duties for at least one of the seasons. Sometimes it seems to be listed as a trainer, other times as maybe the youth team coach. He certainly did work with the Italian Olympic side at the London Olympics.
Yeah, and that's quite interesting in itself because Ferruccio Nova, the president of Torino, he knew that they could not compete with Juventus when it came to financial resources. So he surrounded himself with football people, guys who'd won the league in 27-28 with Torino, but also Leslie Leavesley. And if you go to the Torino Museum in Gugliasco, you'll see his personal diaries, which were donated by his son, Bill, who I think lives in Doncaster. You had Vittorio Pozzo, the Italy manager, you know, the most successful manager of all time, if you like, in that he won two World Cups.
Back to back.
Dropping in and giving his opinion on things. And then you had Erbstein, who'd obviously not only worked in Italy, but all over the world. Famously, I think, brought the WM, Herbert Chapman's kind of innovation, to Italy. And no one else was really playing that. And it took a long time for people to catch up when it came to playing that as well. A lot of people just could not really cope with it. And was someone who, in Erbstein, was able to bring in training from other disciplines as well. His daughter was a very famous prima ballerina. And when it came to teaching footwork, skill, would get these guys to do dance lessons, you know, as well.
A lot of what we would think of even now is very modern ideas. So from the 1942-43 season, having been pipped by Roma for the 42 title, They then go on this run in which they lose only 17 of 170 league matches. This is with that interim of the war going right through to 49 when, and the fateful flight back from Lisbon. Only losing 17 of 170 league matches, establishing a trademark style, establishing a trademark blitz when their captain and key figure, Valentino Mazzola, would roll up his sleeves and they would just destroy teams. There's a famous match against Roma where they're 1-0 down at half-time and Mazzola, as they're coming out for the second half, shouts at the rest and rolls his sleeves up at the start of the second half and they win 7-1. And they were that kind of team.
Well, the great story about that, and Sinisa Mihajlovic, when he got the Torino job, told this. He was hanging around the training ground one day and this old guy in his sort of 80s and 90s, and he was just telling him stories from that age. And there was this station master who used to basically come to the stadium with his little horn, and whenever either Torino were behind, which wasn't often, and whenever they were bored, which was a lot of the time because it was just too easy for them, he would toot his horn, and that was the sign where Mazzola would roll up his sleeves, and for 15 minutes they would just put on a show and blow teams away.
Right. Charge.
Prima salvato dal palo su tiro di Ossola, sentimenti abbattuto da questa ripresa al volo di Lloyd. Il 102esimo derby ha accresciuto la tiro dei campioni, 46 vittorie contro 34. Parola è avvilito.
So Valentino Mazzola, who's the iconic figure of this period, who Novo had brought in after his work with Venezia, pipping Torino to the Coppa Italia, and I think having a hand in them missing out on the 1942 title. He brings in Mazzola and he brings in his kind of midfield partner, Ezio Loic.
L'Elefante.
So, Mazzola, why is he such an iconic figure?
He had this sort of larger-than-life charisma. I mean, the image of him pulling up the sleeves, you know, when we talked earlier about how they combined athleticism and work rate with technique, you know, he was the superstar. He was the matinee idol. At the time, people like that didn't, you know, they had other guys who did the work for him. And yet, he very much relished that side of the game as well. Torino also stood for something at the time, and certainly they did again in the 70s, which is, you know, in this city, Turin, which is sort of different from the rest of Italy, because obviously they were under French rule, and then in like sort of the original incarnation of Italy, they were kind of the first part. You know, Italy was kind of put together piecemeal, adding bits here and there. They were kind of the original part. The reason the Azzurri play in blue is that that's the color of the House of Savoy, which is the Italian royal family.
They were based in Turin. That was the original capital.
That's right, yes. Of course, we had the sense to go and get rid of them, and we did rig a referendum to do it. But that's a whole other story. That's when, in popular parlance, you know, the Agnelli family became the royalty of Italy. Uh-huh. And you know, the city Turin, which would later be invaded by people from the south of Italy to go and work in the factories. But even then, they had an outsized importance in the city. Turin has always been an automotive center. If you go back to sort of the 1920s, there were, I think, 7 different car manufacturers in Turin. You know, and then there was one, Fiat, and everybody worked for Fiat. And you could almost have this demarcation. So for a lot of people, not so much the people from the south who moved there, many of whom moved there in the 50s. But I think for local Torinesi who maybe worked for Fiat or whatever, they said, you know what? I spend, you know, 8 hours of my life sleeping, couple hours a day grooming and eating, 10 hours a day in your freaking factory. The rest of the time, I am not your servant. And so in some ways, it was almost a way of establishing a sense of independence, a sense of freedom, of not being, you know, part of the Agnelli Fiat machine, if you will. And in some way, Valentino Mazzola, of course, not being from Turin, also helped that, you know, in the sense that we are something bigger. You know, we are Turin. We are named after the city, but we transcend it.
And when you speak about transcending it, the other obvious way was what they meant for the Italian national side and a national team that in the post-war years, in the rubble of the post-war years, became of huge importance. And there, impact on the Azzurri is unprecedented. I think there's no I can't think of a team, unless it's, I don't know, something from Ceausescu or something like that, that where one club dominates the national side to that extent. I mean, when you look at their results, they beat England 4-0 in 48 with seven players from Torino. They beat Hungary with a young Ferenc Puskás in the side, 3-2. All 10 outfield players were Torino back then. Every time the Italian national side took to the field, it was essentially Il Grande Torino with one or two ringers.
Gentili ascoltatori, buonasera. È Nicola Carosi che vi parla. Madrid, 27 marzo 1949. Per la prima volta l'incontro Spagna-Italia si svolge nella capitale iberica. Le due nazionali si sono già incontrate 13 volte. 5 vittorie azzurre, 3 spagnole, 5 pareggi. Ma ecco gli italiani. Maciccaluppo, Anavazzi e Castigliano. Ballarin con il debuttante Amadei. Rigamonti e Menti. Beccattini, altro esordiente come Lorenzi qui con Carapellese. Mazzola è il capitano degli azzurri.
There's a great story about that Hungary game in that Potter was very reluctant to field an all Torino side for Italy. So he was gonna play Carlo Parola, the Juventus player. Who,
and Panini who, silhouette.
Exactly, the guy whose scissor kick is immortalised in that Panini sticker. But he was in Glasgow playing in a exhibition game for the rest of Europe against Britain, which the rest of Europe lost. And he was due to fly back in order to play in this game. But there was some dispute going on between the French and Italians, and the French closed their airspace, so he basically could not get back. So that's why they ended up playing 10 Torino players rather than 11. And the only player who wasn't a Torino player was the goalkeeper. And Bacigalupo, the Torino goalkeeper, held no grudge against, was it Sentimenti?
Who was in goal. Quarto, right?
Yeah. And that when in the Superga crash, when they were going through some of the personal effects, they found Bacigalupo's wallet. And in there was a photo of him and Sentimenti, Quarto. So...
Very poignant.
Because of World War II, Italy had the longest run ever, hopefully. Hopefully that will always be the case as defending world champions, because obviously it was 12 years. And they were coming after, you know, in a situation where they had won the two previous World Cups. They'd won the 1936 Olympics, which, you know, some people can giggle at, but, you know, was considered important at the time. And they were so reliant, obviously, on Torino, as James just said, that it's not surprising that then that affected everything, including the 1950 World Cup in Brazil, where they took the boat and they were terrible, and once they got there and whatnot.
So you have a team here that's completely dominating on a national level and also at a club level. Mazzola himself, a midfielder, but a guy who could play from all accounts pretty much anywhere. The 46-47 season, he scores he's top scorer in the league with 29 goals. The following season, he gets 25. He had 118 goals in 204 appearances. He also still holds the record for the fastest hat-trick in Serie A, which he got 3 goals in essentially 180 seconds against Vicenza in 47. And the team are absolutely flying. He is a folk hero, as you say, Gabrielli, but all the team by now, Bacigalupo, Loic, Orsola,
Gabetto,
Orsola, Menti, whose Rigamonti.
Son would later go on and... Well, I think he ran in the Olympics with Pietro Manea, their most famous Italian athlete, really. You look up and down Italian football, its geography, the stadiums that are named after, you know, Rigamonti, Brescia Stadium,
Menti,
Vicenza. Really goes to show the kind of legacy that this team had.
And the weird thing is that this being, what, the 40s, they've all got other occupations. And Ezio Loic has a paint business. There's a radio clip, actually, of Franco Orsola discussing with him the range of colours that they offer. And Loic, in a possibly a scripted moment, suggests that he must watch out for the claret colour, because if you get that on your Scudetto, you're never getting it off.
Se tu dipingi anche una volta sola con questo color granata, mettiamo uno Scudetto, non c'è più niente da fare, non lo mandi più via. E tu, Gabetto, come preferisci il pubblico? Come spettatore di partito o come cliente di bar? È difficile rispondere, vero Orsola?
Proprio così, per quanto la risposta sia resa più agevole dal fatto che quasi sempre i tifosi sono anche degli ottimi consumatori.
Fascinating to actually hear these mythical figures speaking. 48-49 then, what proves to be their final season, and they're flying once again. There's talk, Dominic Bliss's book suggests that Livesley's actually been offered both a coaching role with Italy by Vittorio Pozzo and possibly even the top job at Juventus.
Well, and also Valentino Mazzola had big offers, and they would later find out that he was being paid double what everybody else was, which they were all okay with, of course, because they had to recognise that I think both Inter and Milan wanted him. Juventus thought that they were getting him, but obviously ended up, I think, pulling out, knowing that the city would descend in, there'd be riots on the streets of Turin if he crossed from Torino to Juventus. So.
Mm. Well, they've been off on a tour of Brazil. They're basically owning football. That season, start of 49, they've beaten Juventus again 3-1. And then their final game in Italy was a league match against Inter at San Siro.
Squadra blocco, squadra armonia, squadra volontà, soprattutto volontà.
Then comes this friendly with Benfica, essentially, with four games still to go in the title race, which, you know, is by and large a formality. But they fly off to Portugal because Francisco Ferreira, the Portuguese captain, is a great friend of Valentino Mazzola's, and he basically asks him to bring Torino along for his testimonial. They play the game, they lose, but whatever. They begin their journey back, they stop at Barcelona, refuel, and then they head back to Turin, and they're about half an hour away from landing when the plane's wing catches a wall of the Basilico Superga, which is on a hill just outside Turin. It's a very, very stormy day. There's no visibility. The plane smashes into the hillside and all 31 people on board perish.
Un crepuscolo durato tutto il giorno, una malinconia da morire. Il cielo si sfaldava in nebbia e la nebbia cancellava Superga. Dice il capellano della basilica, ho sentito un rombo paurosamente vicino, poi un colpo, un terremoto, poi silenzio e una voce di fuori, è caduto un apparecchio. Questo è il terrapieno che
flying to Torino back from Lisbon, hit the spire of Superga Cathedral, 10 miles outside Turin, and burst into flames. All its 31 passengers were killed. Among the dead was the team's English trainer, Leslie Leavesley, an old Manchester United player. 10 miles between safety and disaster.
Well, after that Inter game, Jimbo, they'd flown from Malpensa in Milan. And the normal thing is when you fly in this, I think it was a charter flight with the same captain, you fly back to the same airport. So there's a lot of speculation as to why they didn't fly back to Milan that day. Was it because the team was absolutely shattered after going straight from that game to playing this friendly? They still had four games to go. Or was it because going to Milan, which is a bigger airport, busier airport than the one in Turin, customs a little bit more stringent, and they were bringing back gifts, cigarettes, a lot, and that sort of thing. And because they were heroes in Turin, they'd just be allowed to kind of just walk through customs and go about their business. In that layover at Barcelona, they bump into the Milan side that have gone to play against Real Madrid, and basically those Milan players, they, you know, sit and have a drink with them at one stage, and they're like, these guys are absolutely shattered, they're knackered. So in that sense, I think that was one of the motivating factors in the decision to fly back to Turin rather than to Milan.
Mm. Well, Torino were proclaimed winners 2 days later of that Serie A season. And for the rest of the campaign, the four remaining matches, they fielded their youth team and all their opponents fielded their youth teams against them. So many extraordinary details. Pozzo, who the Italy manager who went up the hill of Superga to ID the bodies.
Mm. That is incredible. There was a guy looking at the bodies and he said, that's Ballerin. And then behind him, no, that's not Ballerin, that's Rigamonti. And that was Pozzo, who just walked up to the top of the hill, had heard about it, felt that he needed to be there, and would end up identifying each and every one of the bodies of the next 24 hours.
A city weeps. It mourns more than a football team, for the Torino was part of their life. Something personal and yet shared by them all has gone. 4 years in
reports of the funeral
of Italy,
suggests figures of around a million people on the streets of Turin, which is not that big a city.
No, it's not. In fact, when Gianni Agnelli died nearly 50 years later, people say that it was the biggest crowd since the funerals of the Grande Torino. And it really was something that...
It was a massive blow to the post-war optimism.
Yeah, it was the setback of sort of, you know, are we going back there? I mean, is this... Were those 6 years between 1939 and 1945, were they actually not an aberration where mankind did unspeakable things to each other? But, you know, is this darkness returning? And obviously one of the iconic, again, images of that is that of Valentino Mazzola's son, who, of course, would go on to, like his dad, become one of Italy's greatest ever.
But he became the heart of another grande team, the Grande Inter.
Yeah, he'd become one of, you know, win two European Cups and become really a symbol of post-war. And in some ways, and this is years later, and obviously it's been romanticized because it was such a tremendous tale and whatever. But this little boy who lost his dad, you know, became sort of the symbol of redemption and life renewing itself and circle of life and all that jazz. But, you know, I think these narratives, these sort of foundational myths are also important and kind of what makes people attach to the past in football.
Mm.
You know, like all those people who talk about Duncan Edwards without ever having seen him, but they're sure that he would have been the England captain and won five World Cups, which, you know, it's the same thing, yeah. I think, with Mazzola.
The curious thing with Torino, though, is the way that this legacy, that the story was almost neglected. The Philadelphia Stadium, where they played, that was their home ground for all the glory years, fell into disrepair. When I went to Italy, I remember they would use it for training sessions, but the thing was dilapidated and falling apart, and it was soon closed for safety reasons. They've now reacquired the site and, to an extent, rebuilt it as a training ground. But
it's beautiful. I went this time last year, and obviously there are still some of the standings.
Uh-huh.
The stands have been reclaimed. The original walls, some of the original turnstiles are all there. And this is a team that lives in the past. Its present is always its past. You know, they play in the Stadio Grande Torino. They train at the Philadelphia. It's inescapable. And
when I went to the Philadelphia, but this would be 92, something like that. We were doing an interview with, I think, Christian Vieri.
Okay.
We were in one of those kind of dusty rooms. This was before kind of sponsors boards and that. Around the corner, there was just something propped up against a wall. And I remember thinking, well, what on earth is that? It was the propeller of the plane that had been carrying them back from Lisbon. It was just parked in a room, much as you would something you just don't know what to do with. Mm. Now, as you say, at Grugliasco, they've established a museum. But I just thought it was an extraordinary thing for the club to just leave it lying around like that.
Yeah. The museum is fantastic. I'd recommend anyone going because all of the artifacts, the relics that they have from that time, there are some personal effects you'd never think they'd have been through a horrific crash, that they're still so incredibly intact.
People of Galazzo, if you want to combine your knowledge of the footy with your knowledge of the footsie, then you need to get yourself over to the Football Stock Market Football Index. Football Index is a new way to profit from your knowledge of Serie A, the Premier League and beyond. Buy and sell players, build a portfolio, earn dividends and sell at a profit. Because you listen to Galazzo, you can try Football Index and trade up to £1,000 entirely risk-free. Just head to footballindex.co.uk, enter the promo code TOTALLY, and if you don't love Football Index, you'll get a full refund with their 7-day money-back guarantee. Download the app or play online at footballindex.co.uk and become a football trader today. T's and C's apply. You must be over 18. Deposit required, and please trade responsibly.
Post-Superga, Torino struggle on. They eventually go down. Italy has its problems. You mentioned the 1950 World Cup and the story we're telling on Mondays, totally, of how, because of the trauma of losing their players in an air crash, Italy sent their team to Brazil on a boat. They essentially did no cardio whatsoever except for jogging around the deck. Got beaten almost immediately and crashed out within two games and were subsequently put on a plane home because by that point, who cared what happened to them, I guess, is the inference. Torino did win a title again in 76 under Gigi Radici, which I always think of as a very curious set of circumstances. And I know that's got its own political backdrop, again, of the 70s and Juve's dominance. And that's something we should look at on another occasion, because it comes after another huge dose of tragedy that this club has suffered, the death of Gigi Moroni, who was going to be the next superstar of Italian and possibly world football.
But the irony here is, what was the name of the pilot of the plane in the Superga?
Meroni. And who was the man who ran him down that day post-match and ultimately killed him on the streets of Turin?
Romero.
Who became?
President of Torino.
Bizarre.
And who at the time was?
Working for Juventus?
He was Juventus's head of communications.
Very strange. What if... Well, two questions really, just to finish off then, about Il Grande Torino. One, why did they never become everyone's team the way that, say, Man United have?
It was simply the era. I mean, I think they became a very popular team among people from that time, but Italian football at the time, most football, was a lot more regional than it is now. Television in Italy started in 1953.
Right.
You know, you had radio, but, and I appreciate the irony of saying this on a podcast, but, you know, if you're a kid, you don't normally get excited by three dudes in a room talking, unless it's the three of us, of course. Without that support of images, without that continuity bleeding on into the 1950s, without there being an impact on the national team as well. Remember, too, this was a country that throughout the 30s, under Mussolini, they loved being spoon-fed tales of great mythic Italian success with the two World Cups and Primo Carnera, the great boxer and whatnot. And then all of a sudden, after the war, all of a sudden you have the war, and then that all ends. And then all of a sudden everything is subdued, the country's rebuilding. While, as James said, they had this incredible symbiosis with the city of Turin, it was a local thing. You know, you could see these guys walking around town doing normal things, but it didn't necessarily go over into other parts of the country.
And Sauro Tomà, who was carrying an injury, I think the only member of the first team who didn't make the trip, the third choice keeper, also stayed behind. And Tomà met years later, who's, as I mentioned, passed away last week. And he was a lovely man, but clearly had, I don't want to sound macabre, but almost spent the intervening years waiting to reunite with his friends who he lost that day, that his life had almost come to a full stop that day. So it's almost meaningless to say what if they hadn't crashed, but you do wonder about the way that the European landscape in football terms evolved. You've got Real Madrid, who they then, you know, the European Cup starts. There was no European Cup during the Grande Torino's years. Had there been one, would we be talking about them the way that the people eulogise about the Di Stefano Real Madrid? Would that team ever have had the dominance, the five straight titles they won in Europe?
Yeah, Eraldo Pecci was the midfielder who played for Torino in the 76 Scudetto winning side, said that, you know, in this city there is a club that has everything, and there is another club that had everything taken away from it. And, you know, you have that has been a constant thread throughout Torino's career, you know, in terms of Superga, Meroni, Giorgio Ferini, the captain, would die of a brain hemorrhage just a few weeks after they won the league title, a year after he'd retired. Lentini, everything that Mondonico, lifting his chair above his head in protest at what was going on in that UEFA Cup final against Ajax. All those things, that they were so close to something. And in the Grande Torino side, they did actually achieve greatness, but usually when it's so close to something and they have it taken away from them.
But when they did achieve greatness, it was Il Grande Torino. We'll finish off then with the sorts of two-time World Cup and Olympic gold medalist Vittorio Pozzo on what Il Grande Torino represents.
Coloro che non l'hanno vista all'opera non possono immaginare il dinamismo e l'accordo stilistico e spirituale che da essa emanava quando l'unità si sentiva messa alla prova. Rimane come un esempio unico, un fulgido esempio per tutti, l'opera del Torino caduto a Superga.
Gabriele, many thanks.
Pleasure.
James Horncastle, to you as well. Golazzo will return next week. We'll also be dealing then with the aftermath of this midweek round, which is... well, the bulk of which is about to get underway. Currently 6 points between Juventus and Napoli. Juve, as we kind of hinted at, heading towards title number 7 in a row. Il Grande Juve. And also that massive battle for the top 4, which Inter laid down a bit of a marker for a spot in there with their 4-0 demolition?
Yeah, of Cagliari.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we'll talk about where we are. We've got some big games coming up this evening. We'll have a look at all of that, where we are when we return next Wednesday. Many thanks for being with us. For now, from all of us here, arrivederci.
You've been listening to Golazzo, the totally Italian football show. It's a Muddy Knees Media production, and for sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com.